said. He flirts himself to a good interview. As they gathered at the table, as Serge carried out a basket of rolls, Richard explained that Corinne's husband was a major art critic, and that her piece for Libération was openly personal as well as repertorial. Corinne said, "Only because I love you so much." Jake, thank God, was quiet. Fiona would have felt personally responsible if he'd made a fool of himself. He was still nursing his cocktail, she was relieved to note. Fiona had snuck the phone with her, tucked it under her leg again. It was nearly 8 o'clock now. Across the room, the balcony door was cracked open. It had warmed up late in the day, and now a pleasant breeze swept through. Corinne asked Richard about his most recent work, the large-scale images that would apparently comprise half the show. A photograph of a mouth, Fiona gathered, would consume an entire wall. Fiona was surprised. She'd assumed this was a retrospective. Serge's Moroccan stew had lamb and apricots, and its spiciness didn't hit you till after you'd swallowed. Jake, who'd brought a notebook but left it on the couch, piped up to ask questions, smart ones, about Richard's age, though not in so many words. How his work had changed, physical limitations, the scope of his career. "It's funny," Richard said. "When I was your age, I assumed it would all be downhill after 50. Well, ageism is the only self-correcting prejudice, isn't it?" Under the table, Fiona flicked open her email. A message from Damien, asking if there had been any news in the past 4 hours. An update from the dog sitter. Jake went quiet again, listening to Richard talk about his preparations, listening reverentially to Richard and Corinne reminiscing. Jake was the one person in the room to whom this was Richard Campo, the man from the documentary, the talent behind that iconic photo of the little girl atop the Berlin Wall, the scandalous presence behind the defiling Reagan series. It was so different when you'd known the person first. Fiona wondered what Damien would say if he saw her sitting here relaxing, if he'd wonder why she wasn't out searching, or if he'd be glad she was taking care of herself, letting the detective do his job. Progress was being made this very moment, even if she wasn't the one making it. She tuned into Richard joking with Jake. "You want to be my assistant? I'm constantly looking for new assistants." "Because he's impossible to work for," Corinne said. "And I promise you the pay is terrible. Even worse than journalism." Serge explained to Fiona that Corinne would give a party for Richard tomorrow night, or rather, her husband would, at their home in Vincennes. "You'll come," Richard said to Fiona. Fiona nodded, but she didn't mean it.
"Can you tell me," Corinne said to Richard, "about the video installations? I do want to write about those. The world doesn't know you well for video."
"This is the fault of the world," Serge put in. "Well," Richard said, and he looked straight at Fiona, as if she were the one who'd asked. "The irony is, the raw material's quite old. These are videos I recorded on VHS through the 1980s, in Chicago. You know, VHS was a nightmare to work with." Fiona caught his meaning, finally, and tilted her head. The '80s in Chicago. Video. To Corinne, he said, "They're optimistic, I believe. They're full of life. I've edited them with a contemporary eye, but the subject is 25, 30 years ago. He faltered, and Fiona was reminded, uncannily, of Christopher Plummer in The Sound of Music, choking up on stage in front of those Nazis, trying to sing about his homeland. He said, "You should interview Fiona while she's here. You can interview me anytime. But her brother and those other boys, they're..." And he stopped, blinked rapidly, waved a hand in front of his face. He went into the kitchen, called from behind the counter. "Who'd like apple tart?"
"He wanted to tell you,"
Serge said to Fiona. She said,
"There's what? Footage? There's footage?"
"No, he's not footage. He's art."
"Okay."
But Fiona felt her pulse in her cheeks. She'd come here to find Claire, but a recovered minute with Nico and Terence, with... That was something. Wasn't that a rescue, too, of some kind? She said, "I want to see it." Corinne laughed.
"So does the world. More than a week we have to wait. And you, too."
It was nearly 10 o'clock, and Fiona resigned herself to the fact that Arnaud had been serious about not calling till morning. Richard served the tart with vanilla ice cream. Then the five of them carried their little plates out to the balcony railing and ate standing up, looking down at the barricaded street. 1985-1986. The university and gallery would be closed to the new year, but both Yale and Bill Lindsay were eager to take advantage of the Sharps being in town for the holidays. Alan Sharp was on the gallery's board of advisors, and after the Briggs themselves, Alan and his wife Esme were the gallery's biggest donors. Lovely, down-to-earth people who'd rather have dinner at Bill's than be wined and dined at Le Perroquet. Yale had known them since his days at the Art Institute, where they were always keen to sponsor a party or an educational event, and he suspected they'd put in a good word for him when he applied at the Brig. They'd insisted on Charlie's presence tonight. And so, on December 30th, the temperature hovering around zero, Yale and Charlie stood on the doorstep of Bill's house in Evanston with a bottle of Merlot, 10 minutes early. They'd walked here from the L. Charlie said, "Let's just circle the block again." But Charlie was the one with a warmer coat, thick gloves. Yale vetoed the trek, and they rang the bell. Dolly Lindsay, Yale had met her once before, briefly, opened the door as if she'd been in a great, frantic hurry to get there. And yet the room behind her was immaculate, and the smell of tomato sauce filled the house. She'd been ready for hours. Dolly was short and plump, her hair in tight curls. If Yale was right about Bill being in the closet, then he'd chosen his wife predictably, plain but put together, sweet enough that she likely forgave a lot. Yale hadn't mentioned his suspicions to Charlie. The last thing he needed was for Charlie to worry about a workplace affair. Dolly said,
"Get in out of that weather."
And then, as if she were delivering a line in the school play, she said,
"And this must be your friend Charlie. Such a pleasure."
Charlie wasn't thrilled to be there. He felt he was neglecting work tonight, and he was worried about Terence, who'd been admitted to Masonic with a sinus infection. But you'd never know it.
"Shall we take our shoes off?" he said. "Your floors are so beautiful. I don't want to track slush in." "Oh, they've seen worse," Dolly said.
She was smiling, blushing. Charlie had already won her over, in two sentences. It helped that his accent contained a top hat and monocle. Yale found himself planted on the couch next to Charlie with a glass of vino, as Bill called it, watching Bill pick out records. Everything was still decorated for Christmas, candles and angels and sprigs of holly. Dolly said,
"I hope you like veal parmesan."
Charlie didn't eat mammals, and they both had issues with veal, but they nodded, said it sounded delicious. Charlie said,
"If it tastes as good as it smells, I'm never leaving your house."
This sent Dolly back into a deep blush, a high-pitched giggle that would have been irritating if it weren't so genuine. She said to Yale,
"I understand it's an exciting time at the gallery."
"We're having fun, at least." Even before the holiday break, the whole situation had been on ice. No further news from Nora, No angry calls from Cecily. Then the surer Yale had become of the painting's authenticity. The more he and Bill stared at the photos, the more Bill ran into his office with some new bit of detective work. The evidence that, yes, Fujita had used that exact shade of green. Look at this. The more it hit him that it wasn't just Cecily and her egomaniacal donor he was up against, but Nora's family. A family that might easily block the transaction, might lock her in the house or intercept her mail. Well, it all sounds wonderful. Bill had put on a Miles Davis album, and now he awkwardly bobbed his head to it. He sat in the big yellow chair across from Yale. He said, "Roman will be here soon." Roman was one of the two PhD candidates who'd be starting as paid interns after the new year, thanks to Mellon Foundation grants. Yale hadn't met him yet, but Bill had been Roman's master's thesis advisor a couple of years ago, back when Bill's position was academic. Roman would be working with Bill again this coming quarter as a curatorial assistant. The other intern, a woman named Sarah, would work with Yale. He phoned to say he had no running water, had to dash over to shower at the gym. The life of the grad student, no. I don't miss it. Charlie, did you do graduate work? Not a day of it, Charlie said, and didn't add that he'd dropped out of university. The best Yale could reconstruct was that Charlie had stopped classes, but just hung out for 3 years on and around the campus of King's College, galvanizing people and leading protests and being generally the crown prince of gay students. Charlie wasn't likely to explain this all to Bill, and Yale was relieved when he excused himself to help Dolly in the kitchen. Charlie was no cook, but he was fantastic at grabbing up a pot to scrub. Yale said, "I think we simply have to drive up to Door County again. You and me this time. You can talk to her, and I'll talk to the lawyer." He steadied his overfilled glass. The red wine had almost splashed onto the arm of the cream sofa. "It's not like she won't be home. It's not like she'll be having a party." "So, just show up unannounced?" "She's 90. We don't have time to wait." Bill sighed, looked around the room as if someone might be hiding in the corner, eavesdropping. "I want to make sure you understand what you're getting into," he said. "I do. The worst case is very bad." It was a scenario that involved their trying to get the art but failing, or, less likely but still possible, procuring the art and then learning it was forged. In either case, Northwestern would lose Chuck Donovan's money for nothing. Bill said, "If Cecily gets word of what we're doing, or if it comes out badly in the end, she's going to take this higher and higher up the ladder, just to cover her own behind. It's only 2 million, but things haven't gone well for her lately." He scooted his chair closer to Yale, and the back legs caught on the edge of the pale oriental rug, curling it over on itself. "I'm willing to try to take the fall for this, because they're not going to fire me. For one thing, I'm actually still tenured, but I can't guarantee what would happen. They might be determined to fire someone simply to prove a point, and that person would be you." Yale wasn't sure who they were, but he nodded. "I doubt they'd throw the entire gallery to the wolves, although..." Charlie stuck his head back through the door. "I've been instructed to check your wine glasses." Yale raised his full one and took a sip. Bill gave a big thumbs up. It must have been clear they were talking business, because Charlie vanished silently. Bill said, "Dolly's already on me to retire. I figure I'm putting in 2 more years at most. And listen, I'll stake the tail end of my career on this, and gladly. But you're a young guy, Yale. You're at the start of things, and we're shooting the moon." A year ago, Yale might have let his nerves back him out of the whole thing. But he felt ready now. He was full, the past few weeks, of an energy he couldn't name. It might have had to do with the way Julian had looked at him at the fundraiser, the residue of feeling chosen, or it might have had to do with the evidence all around him that life was short, that there was no point in banking on the future instead of the present. He said, I want to do this. On a tangential note, Bill said, pointing a long finger, let's talk about interns. Bear with me, because it's related. So, there's Sarah and there's Roman. Both excellent. You were going to have Sarah, but I've been thinking I'll swap. I want you to have Roman instead. Yale was confused. He's an art history guy, right? He wouldn't want to work in development. Well, sure he would. We've discussed it. He's interested in museum administration. Maybe that'll be his next degree. Who knows? He's the perpetual student type. Okay, his dissertation's on Baltus, so he'll, well, it's not exactly Norris period, is it? But close enough. He's innocent. A lovely young man. I want you to have him. Dolly was back in the room, putting out a bowl of mixed nuts. She said, Roman is wonderful. Thank you, Yale said to Bill. He wasn't sure what had just happened, but it seemed that thanks were expected. And I'll take Sarah. Dolly looked absolutely delighted. The opposite of how most wives would react to their husband bringing on a young female intern. She disappeared into the kitchen, and then Bill said, And if you think it might be helpful, we can take him to Wisconsin with us. When the Sharps showed up, shrieking and laughing about the cold, Yale felt instantly more at ease. Esme hugged him and exclaimed that Charlie looked just as she'd pictured. Yale had an excuse now to stand, to move around the room. The Sharps were only in their 40s, but Alan Sharp held the patent on the shut-off device used in almost every gasoline nozzle in the world, and now they split their time between Maine and Aspen, and a small place in the Marina Towers. They were odd donors, intensely interested in helping the brig build its collection. Alan had gone to Northwestern, and Esme had studied architecture, but with no art of their own. Beautiful people with matching chestnut hair, matching Greek noses. I know we ought to start collecting, Esme said to him once, but I don't see the point in hogging something. Yale wished the Sharps would adopt him, would give him and Charlie a room in their little wedge of Marina Tower. Bill spread the photos on the coffee table, and Yale told the Sharps the full story. Bill had instructed him to leave the Renko Novak pieces out, and because there was no way to authenticate those anyway, Yale didn't see the harm. They weren't relevant to the conversation. Charlie and Dolly listened intently, too, and Yale realized he hadn't explained this all to Charlie, not in so many words. Well, Charlie had been so busy. It's incredible, Alan said. I'm embarrassed to say I haven't heard of Fujita. And because Bill didn't jump in, Yale said, He was a fixture in Paris in the 20s, a celebrity, just about the only Japanese man in France. There was an unfortunate period during the war when he moved home and made propaganda, but no one cares about that anymore. Alan laughed. Don't they? I think my old man would care. Yale leaned close, like he was telling a secret. Well, one of his drawings just fetched 400 grand in Paris. I don't think that buyer minded. Charlie gave Yale a look, and it took Yale a moment to decipher the look as impressed, proud. It was rare that Charlie saw him in action. If Yale had a wife, she'd be dragged along to every dinner with a donor, every alumni event. She'd wear a short dress and flatter the men and then imitate the wives on the way home. Or, well, no. Maybe if he were straight, he'd have married someone like Charlie, too busy with her own life to play the nodding and smiling game. The doorbell rang, and Bill and Dolly both jumped to answer it. Yale had imagined that a person named Roman would be built like a soldier, but the young man who stepped inside half-frozen was small and blonde, Morrissey glasses magnifying his eyes. He wore a black turtleneck, black trousers. I'm so sorry to be late, he said, handing Dolly a small poinsettia that must have been on post-Christmas sale at Dominic's. He looked like an undergrad, in fact. Although Yale soon found out he was 26, that he started an MFA in painting before switching to art history. Roman turned down a drink and perched awkwardly on the end of the sofa to chat with the Sharps about the research he'd done in Paris last summer. He had a quiet voice, kept his hands glued to his knees. He said, "My mom was worried I wouldn't want to come back." Esme laughed and said, "Yes, why did you?" "Well, I mean, my education and my..."
"She's teasing," Alan said.
"Christ, Esme, you've traumatized the kid." Roman was adorable, and Yale figured him first of all for gay, why else the strangeness from Bill, but also for the type who didn't even know it yet himself. Yale might have wound up like that if he hadn't, sophomore year at Michigan, gotten Mark Breen as his macroeconomics TA. Older, beautiful, confident, persuasive. 5 minutes in Mark's apartment, and Yale couldn't remember his own past or anything else he'd ever felt. Dolly asked Roman if he'd gone home for Christmas.
"Yes. Well, I've got 6 brothers and sisters, so we all converge on the house. Northern California."
7 kids, Esme said. The family, it turned out, was Mormon. Yale could sense Charlie appraising Roman, too. He wasn't Charlie's type, but Charlie did have a thing for glasses. Before he got so insecure, they used to play Who Would You Screw? At the beach or at the airport. One of them would identify 3 men. The other had to pick 1 hypothetical lay, and only one, and the other would guess which he'd chosen. And Charlie always went for men with glasses. Yale teased him about his Clark Kent fetish. Charlie said, "So you'll be working in the gallery?" "Actually," Bill said, "he'll be working under Yale." Dolly invited them all to the table, and when Charlie went to wash his hands, Yale followed him around the corner and down the hall, touched his arm outside the bathroom. He whispered, "Bill just sprang that on me. The intern thing." Charlie smiled thinly. "I wonder if Dolly made him switch," Yale went on. Everyone was finding seats back in the dining room, exclaiming over the good smells. "Do you think? It was so sudden. It was weird." Charlie whispered too. "It's okay. You expect me to freak out?" "Yes, he did." "I'm not some monster, okay? I'm not going to flip my lid every time you come in contact with someone."
"I know," Yale said. "I didn't mean it like that."
At the table, after the Sharps had both drunk a fair amount of wine, after they grilled Charlie about his newspaper and asked him for travel recommendations and raved over Dolly's cooking, Yale looked for his moment. He turned the conversation back to the donation and the plans to visit Nora again, leaving out that they hadn't been invited, leaving out the entire issue of Nora's family and Chuck Donovan and the development office, and said, "I want to float something a little unorthodox." Esme said, "I love unorthodox. This donor has no assets beyond the collection. She can't pay for authentication, and she can't endow maintenance on the works. Sometimes there are grants for restoration, but not authentication, because..." Esme nodded. "Because it's a gamble." Alan rested his fork on his plate. "Now, I have no idea if this would be acceptable to her," Yale went on. "But she doesn't seem to have an ego. I'm thinking if someone wanted to endow those things, we might put 2 names on the collection. Not a quid pro quo, but, you know, an in honor of your generosity deal." Bill said, "The Lerner Sharp collection, for instance." Esme and Alan glanced at each other.
"We're intrigued," Esme said.
"This is putting the cart before the horse a bit," Yale said. Esme raised her glass.
"Well, here's to the carts. May the horse catch up."
On the way to the L, Charlie said,
"If you have to have a hot intern,
At least it's a Mormon virgin. Yale laughed. No way, Charlie said. Not a virgin. He has a girlfriend. A little blonde girlfriend who lives, conveniently, 3 hours away. Sweater sets and pearls. Sees her every other weekend. Yale said. She can't figure out why he won't propose. Republican. She is, at least. And her parents. He pretends to be. He doesn't actually vote. But his work is on Baltus, Yale said. Do you know who that is? All these naked young girls. Really controversial. Exactly. Exactly what? You have one confused turnip on your hands. Yale, because the street was completely empty, swung Charlie around to kiss him. Charlie had arranged to take the paper's staff out for a year-end lunch the next day, before people headed to their various New Year's Eve celebrations. Charlie and Yale were planning to visit Terrence at Masonic instead of partying. He called yesterday and said he was ready for visitors. Apparently, they did a good job celebrating holidays on the new AIDS unit. But Terrence didn't expect them to make a huge deal of ringing in a year few of them would see to the end. New Year's was his favorite, though, and he wanted to do it right. Or at least as well as he could. Fiona would pop in early, but then she had to head back to her nanny job so the parents could go out on the town. I need you guys, too, Terrence had said. It doesn't have to be midnight. I just want my party. Yale could have used a real celebration. Some pure stress relief. But the staff lunch counted, he supposed. He liked these people. They would celebrate now. And tonight, Yale and Charlie would stay sober and walk to Masonic together. They'd sidestep puddles of vomit on the way home. At noon, 12 staffers plus Yale crowded around smashed-together tables at the Melrose. They passed around yesterday's issue, containing Richard's photo essay. The write-up of the fundraiser had appeared last Monday, but Richard had needed more time. This was art, not reportage. As the paper made its way toward the bench where Yale was sandwiched, he felt irrationally uneasy, as if Richard had managed a photo of him and Julian gazing at each other in the bathroom. But no. Here instead was a shot, snapped from below, of Yale and Charlie listening to the speeches, Yale looking emotional. It must have been taken right before he broke down. There was a shot, too, of Cecily laughing with two men, presumably the friends she came with. What's her deal? Gloria asked and reached over to point. She was cute. Yale said, straight and confused. She kind of hit on me once. They all found this hilarious. Charlie called down the table. Women used to hit on me all the time, before I started losing my hair. And, good employees, they clamored their protest. Yale knew most of the staff well, although there'd been some turnover. Nico, for one. And two others of the original crew were sick now, too. Is it terrible that I want to replace them all with women? Charlie had said that fall. It's insurance. Dykes won't die on me. They won't even take maternity leave. Yale had answered that yes, it was terrible. Blessed be the dykes, Charlie said, for they shall inherit all our shit. Yale mentioned to Dwight, the copy editor, that he was about to head up to Door County again, and Dwight, who'd grown up vacationing there, had all sorts of advice for him, most of it seasonally inappropriate. Dwight was a tedious person, but Yale hadn't caught a typo in Out Loud all year. Dwight also told him about the German POWs who'd been sent to the peninsula during World War II to pick cherries, and how many of them had stayed and married local girls. Yale logged this away as fodder for the ride up. Down at Charlie's end of the table, though, something was wrong. Charlie had his head in his hands, and he'd gone white, and he was saying, "Fuck, fuck, fuck." "I'm so sorry," Raphael was saying. "I thought you'd know before I would." Yale said, "What?" And Charlie shook his head urgently. It was something to be dropped. Something to talk about at home. Meanwhile, no one at Yale's end seemed to have heard whatever was said. They dutifully found conversations to cover the awkward silence. Dwight asked to taste Gloria's tomato soup. But then Charlie was up from the table, heading out the door to the payphone without his coat. Through the window, Yale could see him dialing, listening, hanging up, retrieving his quarter, dialing again, 4 times. When he came back, he didn't sit down but reached across the table to Yale. He handed him his credit card and whispered, "Take care of everyone, okay?" And then he turned and walked out. The people sitting at what had been Charlie's end of the table didn't seem shocked, just chagrined, as if they'd made a horrible mistake. Yale squeezed his way off the bench past Gloria and went to fill Charlie's vacant chair. He said quietly, "What just happened?" The two men on either side, Raphael and a new guy, both started to talk and then stopped. Raphael finally said, "It's Julian Ames."
"Oh, fuck."
Yale felt faint, felt himself go as pale as Charlie had.
"No,"
he said.
"Fuck."
But they weren't contradicting him. Weren't saying, "No, we only meant he broke his leg. We only meant someone beat him up." He looked at them. Then they looked at their plates. Yale's breath wasn't coming on its own. And terribly, half his horror was selfish. Had he actually considered going up to Julian's apartment? He hadn't actually done it, had he? He hadn't gone up there and then blocked it out, and here he sat in denial? He really hadn't. He'd had vivid dreams about it since, but he hadn't done it. No, more important, Julian. Beautiful Julian. Julian, who kept talking about the cure. Yale wondered if this was in fact what Julian had been trying to tell him in the bathroom. A confession of illness mistaken for a confession of love. He said to Raphael, "You heard this firsthand?"
It was his birthday present to himself, to get tested. That's kind of all I know. Not from Julian, from Teddy Naples."
Julian's birthday was December 2nd. The Howard Brown fundraiser had been... It had still been Hanukkah, hadn't it? The 13th. So no, he wouldn't have had the results by then. Unless he already wasn't feeling well. Unless that was the reason he'd finally done it. The new guy said, "I mean, if it's just the virus, he could have a long time. Years." Raphael said, "What I heard was they called him on Christmas Eve. He woke up because the phone was ringing, and he thought it was his mom calling for Christmas. And it was the nurse, saying to come in for his results." The whole table was listening now, satisfying their own curiosity. No one seemed personally upset, just concerned for Yale. Either they didn't know Julian well, or Yale and Charlie were the last to hear. Yale reached for Charlie's half-full glass of water and watched his own hand shake. He should call Julian. But that was clearly what Charlie had tried. He should chase after Charlie, figure out where he was going. But Yale was the one with the credit card, and people still had food in front of them. Raphael said, "Let's take this down the street. Let's get you a beer." Charlie wasn't at the apartment when Yale got home 2 hours later. He felt disappointed, to an extent that surprised him. He'd wanted to talk it over, to lie there on the bed together staring at the walls and swearing and rehashing any details they'd picked up. But there was more to it. By holding Charlie, Yale could begin to atone for ever thinking of starting up with Julian. The tighter he held Charlie, the more he could take it back. At 9 o'clock, Yale headed to Masonic alone with some magazines and a paper party hat for Terrence. He hadn't been up to the new AIDS unit yet, and he took the wrong elevator, had to wind his way through the pulmonology ward. But then there it was. Christmas lights and streamers on the nurse's station.
A nurse, who looked like Nell Carter, asked Yale if he wanted sparkling cider.
Sure, he said. Then she poured it into a little Dixie cup.
He's got a new roommate in there today, she said. Angry guy, but he's out cold now. Terence is awake.
Yale tried to peek at this new roommate as he walked in, tried to see if it was anyone he knew. But it was dark on that side of the curtain, and all he could see was the bottom of someone's chin, stubble and purple lesions on a hollow jawline. Terence was eating a chocolate pudding with a plastic spoon, a cannula in his nose for oxygen, an IV taped to his wrist bone. He looked even thinner than he had at the fundraiser, but better, too. Happier, at least.
Hey, Terence said. You want to eat this for me?
His voice was rough, strained. I'm tempted, Yale said, sitting down. But those artificial flavors are for your health and recovery. Yale asked if Charlie had been in. Terence said no, just Fiona.
Why? What's wrong?
Nothing. We just got our signals crossed. He said, hey, don't talk, okay? I'll talk. This place is nice. Seriously, you got a TV lounge out there? This is Club Med.
Club Dead.
No, no talking. I made your veggie chili on Christmas. It turned out okay, but I'm no expert. Terence said,
you know the hardest thing about having AIDS?
It had quickly become an old joke, but Yale still laughed. Yeah, he said. Telling your parents you're Haitian.
No, Terence cracked a wide grin. It's actually the dying part.
He started laughing, and then he started coughing. But it was okay. It was okay. Yale remembered, so vividly, Terence carrying Fiona down the hall of the suburban hospital where Nico's parents had insisted on moving him, carrying her like a baby as she sobbed on his neck. She had stubbornly refused to go into Nico's room without Terence, and all the social worker had managed to broker was an hourly changing of the guard. Mr. and Mrs. Marcus, to whom Fiona wasn't speaking, would spend an hour at his bedside while Terence and Fiona sat in the ICU waiting area. And then Terence and Fiona would get half an hour while the Marcuses went down to the cafeteria. Yale and Charlie and Julian and Teddy and Asher and a rotation of Nico's other friends filled in the gaps. Yale was the one there with Fiona and Terence. The three of them were stepping off the elevator when the terrible nurse with the spiky hair came toward them, told Fiona she should go in there now, that this was the time.
Can I bring Terence? She said.
And the nurse looked put out and said she could maybe get the social worker out of his meeting, and Fiona said, I'm not going in without him. Fiona sat down then on the bench. And Yale didn't know whether to look at her or to look at Terence, who was shaking, his hands on the windowsill, or if maybe he should just leave. If this was the point at which he didn't deserve to be here anymore. And after 30 seconds, Fiona stood up and said,
I'm so sorry, Terence.
And ran down to Nico's room. Yale strode over to the nurse's station, said, yeah, let's get the social worker here. This is not okay. This is not okay. But while they were waiting for him, Fiona came back out, looking both 12 and 100, but not 21. She was convulsing, sobbing so hard that she made no noise. Behind her, Mrs. Marcus started wailing. The doctor came out of the room and toward Terence, and Yale prepared to catch him as he fell. But Terence, once the doctor had confirmed what they knew he would, did not collapse. He said to the doctor, in a voice like hollow stone,
I'll be back in 2 hours. You're going to clean him up, right? And they'll have their time. And I will be back in 2 hours.
His knee was still hurt from running into the cleaning cart that morning. But he scooped Fiona up like she weighed nothing and walked straight out of the hospital. Neil stayed back to call Charlie and everyone else from the nursing station phone. He found out later that Terrence had carried Fiona around the outside of the hospital for 20 full minutes until she was ready to come back in and call for a ride. That someone, concerned that a black man was carrying a sobbing white woman around the parking lot, called the police. And an officer showed up and trailed them slowly, until Fiona shouted that she was fine, that it wasn't illegal for a person to carry another person, was it? And now it was Terrence in the bed. And at least this was a much better place. But did it matter in the end? And soon it would be Julian. Terrence's eyes had closed. And Yale sat there a long time, relaying gossip. Yale sang him Auld Lang Syne, croaky and off-key, till Terrence whapped him with the back of his IV-free hand to make him stop. The whole time, Yale thought Charlie might show up. But he didn't. Terrence opened his eyes.
Is it midnight yet?
It's 10:40. But we could watch the ball drop in New York. Can you hold out 20 minutes? He got the little TV in the corner working, showing a Times Square that Terrence would never visit again. Terrence watched the ball, and then he said quietly,
I made it. 1986, man.
He closed his eyes and fell asleep. Yale didn't feel he should go yet, or maybe he didn't want to, and so he sat there a few more minutes. The door opened, and Yale thought it might be Charlie, but it was just a nurse, checking that everything was all right. Yale squeezed Terrence's thin hand as hard as he dared. He said,
You can't die of a fucking sinus infection.
Charlie wasn't at home either. Yale left a long message on Julian's answering machine, shamefully relieved that he hadn't picked up. I want you to let us know what we can do, he said. Some people. I mean, Nico and Terrence had each other, you know? And if you don't have anyone, which isn't what I mean, you have all of us. He wondered how Teddy was doing. Teddy and Julian had been on and off for years, and he must be terrified, on top of devastated. Yet Teddy, despite all his time in the bathhouses, all his time in the back rooms of clubs doing things that made Yale squeamish to imagine, seemed perfectly healthy so far. He could hear Charlie and Asher both, chastising him for that line of thought. From Charlie, it's not about the numbers, it's about the condoms. From Asher, if we had more bathhouses, we'd have less illness. You know why? We'd have less shame. Once, Teddy had drunkenly whispered to Yale, like it was the best secret, You know why I don't have it? You can't get it if you always top. And Yale had tried to give him data, had said that was like girls who thought you couldn't get pregnant in summer, that you couldn't apply rules to a virus this random. Yale said, Look, you ever get soap up in there? Things go both ways. If Teddy didn't already know, deep down, that he had it, he had to know now. They were human dominoes. How could Teddy not know he was the next domino in line? It wasn't till 2 a.m. that Charlie walked in the door. Yale had been sleeping in sweatpants on the couch, by the lights of the small Christmas tree. Charlie's face was pinched, and he moved like a broken puppet. Yale asked, as gently as he could, where he'd been, and Charlie said, Walking. He sat on the couch, and Yale sat up and put his head on Charlie's shoulder. Charlie's body gave off cold like an open refrigerator. Yale took the blanket he'd been using and covered Charlie with it, too. Charlie said, It was just the final straw. Not that it's final. That's the thing. It's a straw, and it broke me. But I know there'll be more. And Yale understood, because that was how he'd felt the night of the fundraiser. He put his hand to Charlie's face, and Charlie shuddered. Sorry, Yale said. I wasn't... I just want to make sure you're okay. What? Are you okay? Of course not. But this seems to be hitting you harder than most.
Charlie snorted.
Most. It was easier to talk to Charlie when they were both looking at the Christmas tree than when they were looking at each other. Yale breathed deeply and said,
I want to reassure you. I've said this before, and I shouldn't have to say it. But I know for some reason it was always a concern for you, and you need to know that Julian and I never touched each other.
Charlie jerked away and looked at Yale wild-eyed.
I'm sorry, I thought that might have been on your mind.
Charlie stood, throwing the blanket off like it was covered with spiders. He said,
Bloody fucking hell, Yale!
Okay, I shouldn't have brought it up. Come back. Come here. Come here.
Charlie did. And he cried for a while into Yale's chest hair. And then he fell asleep there.
2015. Arnaud had asked her not to call till 10 a.m., so Fiona called at 10:01. He didn't answer, and so she tried again. And then she killed time by showering. At 10:26, he answered. He said,
You got some rest?
Tell me, she said.
I have photos, if you'd like to see.
Was it them?
Yes, yes.
Was there... Did they have... Was it just them?
Two adults.
Listen, I can describe these forever, or you can look for yourself. They agreed to meet at noon at a place in Saint-Germain called Sushi House. Not really Fiona's idea of Paris, but at least she pronounced it easily for the taxi that took her there. And when they sat down and she made herself look at the menu, kept herself from diving across the table to rip open Arnaud's messenger bag, she could also understand the food being described. Sake nigiri, ikura, miso. Arnaud told her he'd waited in his car till 11, and at last Kurt and Claire had come walking past his window, hand in hand. Arnaud held his phone out over the table.
You ready? He said.
She didn't understand at first. She'd been expecting him to pull out a stack of glossy 8x10s, but the photos were on his phone. Of course they were. The first was just of Kurt, a close-up.
It's him, she said.
She waited to be overwhelmed with rage at the sight of his face, but instead she felt just the buzz of recognition, the click of encountering an old friend, which, after all, he was. Fiona couldn't ever see him without also seeing the kid he'd been, the smart, nervous boy who would rattle off facts about German submarines and spy planes. The phone was still in Arnaud's hand, and so she said,
Okay, I'm ready.
Next. But the next photo showed both Kurt and a tall woman with thick black hair. They were hand in hand, and the woman held a plastic shopping bag. It was not Claire. She yanked the phone from him, scrolled to the next photo and the next. They were taken in rapid succession, so it looked like a flip book as the two figures moved down the sidewalk.
No, she said. Fuck!
She was angry at Arnaud, which made no sense.
No.
She felt trapped in the booth, suffocated under the yellow lights and quiet music.
It's not her.
How does that even remotely look like her?
She could have dyed her hair.
What, she dyed herself a different nose, too? She dyed herself taller?
Okay, he said. Calm down. It's good, yes? This means she's not with him anymore.
She smacked the phone face down next to the soy sauce, grabbed her purse.
Where are you going? Order some food, okay?
So, we have some more steps to take. We need to plan those out.
Here. Drink water.
She put the glass to her forehead instead of drinking from it. And when the waitress came by, Arnaud ordered for her.
Let me see again, she said.
And Arnaud unlocked his phone, handed it back. Kurt's hair was pulled into a bun, his face shaved. He looked maybe half Hosanna, Hard to tell with the woman. Long hair parted down the middle. Fiona couldn't see, washed out as this woman was by the streetlights, if she had makeup on. She wore a coat, but her legs were cut off by Arnaud's camera. Fiona studied each shot again, as if clues would be lurking in the background. Arnaud said, "Does the group have, do you say, polygamy?" He pronounced it like a French word. "Yes. I mean, yes, that's the word. But they don't, actually. Thank God." Was she really thankful? It meant Claire didn't live in that apartment, that she might not even be in Paris. But wait, no, the video. The video was in Paris, and Kurt was in Paris. So Claire had been in Paris, at least. "If Claire left him," she said, "she probably left France, too. She's... How does immigration even work? You can't just stay somewhere, right? If you're not a citizen?" Arnaud shrugged. "Plenty of people stay illegally." What if, the very day Fiona got here, Claire had decided to show up at her door in Chicago? What if she'd knocked, went away, came back, figured Fiona had moved? What if she'd come by the store, asked around, was told that Fiona was out of the country? Fiona should call a neighbor. She should have left a note for Claire, clearly marked and taped to the front door. But no, she was being ridiculous. Why would Claire choose that exact moment to come home? Fiona hadn't felt this urgency a month ago. It was only the video that had made everything seem so immediate. She hadn't left town since Claire went missing, but she'd been gone all day plenty of times, and some nights, when she stayed over at a date's house or once, crashed at a downtown hotel for a wedding. And the world hadn't fallen apart any further than it already had. Their food had arrived, and Arnaud gestured with chopsticks. "I can, for a little extra money, I can gain entry to the flat. Maybe find some more information." "Like, pick the lock?" There was avocado roll in front of her, and she was so hungry she went for it with her fingers. He laughed. "No, like, bribe the landlord." "Why not just approach Kurt?" "Because if he doesn't cooperate, then we're through. But if we look around first, then we know more, and we can still talk to him later. This neighborhood, I'm sure we can bribe our way in. It's not kosher, you understand? This is why the extra money. I'm not trying to rip you off. But for something like this, a little extra. Just 100 euro.
"I understand."
"Plus the cost of the bribe. So 150.
Can I come with you?"
Arnaud looked exasperated. He stuck a tuna roll in his mouth.
"Sorry," she said. I know, but you don't even know what to look for. If I'm there and I see something that used to be Claire's, I'd recognize it. You wouldn't."
Arnaud exhaled slowly. Invisible smoke from the pipe he ought to have had. Or at least a cigarette. And a trench coat. Today he wore a bright yellow V-neck tee and jeans. "I might only have 10 minutes to get in and out." Fiona said, "Wouldn't the landlord be more likely to let you in if I came too? If we explained that my daughter's missing?" "No," he said. "But look, yes, okay, if I get in, I'll bring you. You won't meet the landlord, but you can come in the flat. Okay?" She promised she'd keep her phone on, be ready to fly across the city. But not yet, not yet. Arnaud had to learn Kurt's schedule, find the landlord, etc., etc. It would take a couple of days. 1986. Yale had the entire place to himself. Bill Lindsay and the gallery registrar had both called in sick. The art handler and the bookkeeper were both part-time. Yale blasted some new order and ate a sloppy turkey sandwich at his desk and worked. He scheduled dinners and researched grants and followed up with the Sharps. He called Nora's lawyer again. Got a message saying the office was closed for the holidays. God, it was January 7th. He prepared to leave a message, but the tape let out a shrill beep that didn't end. He wrote to both Nora and the lawyer saying they'd be driving up next week unless he heard back that they shouldn't. He poured himself into reimagining the official gallery brochure. When he showed up the next day and the office was still empty, he decided to call people to invite them up to see the place. It would help to keep his mind off Julian. How close he'd come to Julian's apartment that night. Teddy and Asher were the two who were available, and they showed up in the afternoon. Yale was glad it wasn't Asher alone. He wouldn't have known how to act. And for totally different reasons, for Charlie reasons, he was glad it wasn't just Teddy. Yale showed them the current exhibit. 12 Ed Paschke portraits that made him dizzy every time he walked through. And then they sat in Yale's office, and Teddy used Yale's MoMA mug as an ashtray. He smoked alarmingly fast, a puff every couple of seconds. They talked about Julian, which was at least better than thinking about Julian. "He's been out every night," Asher said. "Doing what?" "Drinking," Teddy said. "Finding other infected guys to fuck?" "He told you this?" "He was joking about Russian roulette." Teddy might have sounded more concerned. This was a sometime lover he was talking about. But then Teddy's love of gossip generally trumped all. He said, "Did Fiona tell you she found him on her couch last week with no shoes or coat? He traded them for like 5 quaaludes in a joint. And this is in the house where she nannies," Asher added. Asher was playing with Yale's 4-color pen, clicking the colors down in rotation. Yale felt out of the loop. How had all this happened in a week? Well, it had been cold. He hadn't gotten out much. Charlie had been throwing himself into the paper harder than ever since New Year's, as if articles about housing laws and drag shows would magically generate a vaccine. If he wasn't at the office or at meetings, he was working at home, his Macintosh humming like a life support machine. He'd joined Asher's effort to bring the Human Rights Ordinance back up for a vote, something he'd formerly wanted to stall on. They knew it would fail. New City Council had zero interest in their rights, but it was a starting point. They'd get in the Trib and on the evening news. Charlie talked about it suddenly, with the zeal of a religious convert. He'd been too tired for sex, or too stressed for sex, or too moody for sex. On Saturday night, they'd gone to see The Color Purple, and when they came home, Charlie couldn't stop ranting about how Spielberg had watered down the lesbian plotline to a single kiss. "I have more contact with my dentist," Charlie said. Yale had unbuttoned Charlie's shirt, tried to lead him to the bedroom. Charlie buttoned his shirt back up, and, pinning Yale to the wall, ran his lips along his collarbone, and then knelt and gave him an efficient blowjob that would have felt disturbingly perfunctory if it hadn't also felt good. Teddy lit another cigarette. He said Julian was planning to refuse any antibiotics, any vitamins, even the papaya enzymes Terrence was always talking about. "There's the combo of the 2 drugs from Mexico, right? I know a guy who brings it up. And Julian doesn't want it," Yale said. "I thought he believed they were about to find a cure." And Asher said, "Belief is a fragile thing." Asher kept leaning his chair back on 2 legs, and Yale worried it would tip. Yale said to Teddy, "You look good. Your face. You can't even tell." Teddy raised his left fingers to the bridge of his nose. "I want him to sue the school," Asher said. "He won't listen." "Well, it doesn't even make sense. Everyone wants me to be madder than I am. Charlie wants me to write a thing, a personal account. It doesn't feel like that big a deal." Asher said, "Teddy, you were attacked. It's nothing compared to people dying, but it's something. And it's related. It's not like it isn't related. Teddy laughed and said, "Remember Charlie yelling at Nico? Outside Paradise?" It was before.